Do you wake up with stiff joints? Not dramatically, but just like that heaviness in your joints and muscles that takes a while to clear. Do you have persistent low-level fatigue that doesn't fully resolve no matter how much you rest? Do you carry weight around your abdomen that doesn't respond the way you'd expect it to dietary effort? Do you have a brain fog that comes and goes without obvious cause? Do you get ill more than you feel you should or take longer to recover? Do you have a skin condition, something like eczema, psoriasis, rosacea, acne, that flares up unpredictably? Do you have joint pain or stiffness that no specific injury explains? Do you have a mood that sits lower than it should, or an anxiety that seems disproportionate to your circumstances? If you said yes to two or more of those things, I want to say something really directly to you. Your body is not failing at random. It is not aging badly. It is not a collection of separate, unconnected symptoms that each require their own specialist and their own partial solution. Your body is inflamed chronically at a level that standard testing almost certainly has not captured, and that your conventional medicine may not have named. And it is trying to tell you something. This episode is about what it is trying to tell you and what to do with that information. Welcome to the Good Health Podcast. I'm Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner, autoimmune and thyroid specialist, author of Optimal You, and founder of the Good Health Clinic. If you've been listening to the last few episodes, you will now have a very clear metabolic picture from what we've discussed. Insulin resistance, its mechanisms, its downstream cascade. You have the autoimmune and thyroid picture, how the metabolic environment drives immune dysregulation and thyroid dysfunction. And today I want to give you the thread that runs through all of it. Chronic inflammation. It is a mechanism behind insulin resistance because visceral adiposity generates a continuous inflammatory cytokine environment. It is the mechanism behind immune dysregulation because the Th17 Treg imbalance that we talked about last week is driven by and expressed as inflammatory signaling. It is the mechanism behind thyroid conversion impairment because inflammatory cytokines directly suppress deiodinase activity. It connects gut permeability to systemic immune activation. It connects the HPA axis to metabolic function. It's not a symptom or a diagnosis. It is a physiological state that underlines almost every chronic condition that I see in clinic. And it is, in the majority of cases, addressable, not through suppression, not through anti-inflammatory medication as a long-term solution to a structural problem, but through identifying and removing the sources that are generating it and supporting the systems that it should be resolving. With that, let's jump straight into today's episode. So let me start with what inflammation actually is, because I think the word is used so frequently and so broadly that it has lost some of its clinical specificity. When people say I'm inflamed or inflammation is bad, they're often collapsing a very important distinction, the distinction between acute inflammation and chronic inflammation. These are not just different intensities of the same process. They are mechanistically distinct, physiologically opposite in their purpose, and clinically requiring completely different approaches. So let's take a look at the two. Acute inflammation. This is the body working correctly. Acute inflammation is one of the most elegant and essential processes in human biology. When tissue is damaged by injury, infection, or any form of cellular threat, the inflammatory response activates rapidly and with precision coordination. Mast cells and resident macrophages in the affected tissue release inflammatory mediators, histamine, prostaglandins, leukotrienes. Blood vessels dilate to increase local blood flow. Vascular permeability increases, allowing immune cells, neutrophils first, then monocytes and lymphocytes, to migrate from the bloodstream into the tissue. Phagocytic cells engulf pathogens and cellular debris. Cytokines signal systemically to produce a fever, fatigue and loss of appetite that are all the hallmarks of acute illness, not side effects of the immune response, but deliberate physiological strategies to create an inhospitable environment for pathogens and redirect metabolic resources to the immune response. Then, critically, resolution. Anti-inflammatory mediators are produced. Things like lipoxins, resolvins, protectins, they're synthesized from omega-3 fatty acids. Neutrophils undergo apoptosis, macrophages clear the debris, the tissue repairs, the inflammatory signal ends, and this entire process in a healthy individual with an acute, resolvable threat is time-limited, self-resolving, and leaves the tissue restored to function. This is inflammation doing exactly what it should. It is not the enemy. It is the immune system's most powerful tool. But what about chronic inflammation when the signal can't resolve? Chronic inflammation is something categorically different. It is what happens when the acute inflammatory response is activated repeatedly, continuously, or at low grade by threats that the immune system cannot fully clear, or by inputs that continuously trigger the inflammatory cascade without the resolution phase following. The key molecular switch is NF-kappa-B, nuclear factor kappa-B. And NF-kappa-B is a transcription factor that sits at the center of the inflammatory response. When it's activated by things like bacterial endotoxins, by oxidative stress, pro-inflammatory cytokines, even by things like hyperglycemia or saturated fats, or by advanced glycation end products, it translocates to the cell nucleus and switches on the genes for dozens of pro-inflammatory proteins simultaneously. So things like the TNF-alpha, the interleukin-6, the interleukin-1-beta, it is the master switch of the inflammatory program. In acute inflammation, NF-kappa-B is activated briefly, does its job, and then it is switched off by the regulatory mechanisms. In chronic inflammation, NF-kappa-B remains activated, continuously switched on at a low level, because the inputs that activate it are not transient threats, but persistent features of the metabolic and lifestyle environment. The resolution program never fully engages. The inflammatory state becomes a resting state. Chronic inflammation is also distinguished from the acute inflammation by the inflammatory cell population involved. Acute inflammation is dominated by neutrophils, short-lived, fast-acting, non-specific. Chronic inflammation is dominated by macrophages and lymphocytes, particularly the M1 macrophage phenotype, which produces large quantities of pro-inflammatory cytokines, and the Th17 lymphocyte population that we talked about last week. These cells don't resolve, they sustain. And at a low level of chronic inflammation, below the threshold that causes the classic signs of acute inflammation, so below the level that would activate that standard CRP testing so that it shows up as positive, this sustained state produces no dramatic symptoms. We don't get the fever or the obvious swelling. There's no single red flag marker, just a persistent systemic cellular level state of activation that you feel as things like fatigue, brain fog, joint stiffness, weight resistance, and mood disruption. The body is fighting a war with no front line, and the metabolic cost is enormous, and standard testing almost never captures it. So let's look at what drives chronic inflammation, and we're going to look at five primary sources here. If chronic inflammation is a sustained physiological signal, the clinical question is, what is generating that signal? Because the treatment of chronic inflammation, genuine treatment, not suppression, begins with identifying and removing sources. So let's look at the five primary sources. And there are some others, but these are just the five that I see very commonly in clinical practice. Source one is the metabolic adipose axis. And we've covered this in depth in the last couple of episodes. So I'll be direct here rather than repeat everything that we've already discussed. Visceral adipose tissue in insulin-resistant individuals is a continuous active inflammatory problem. It produces TNF-alpha, interleukin-6, interleukin-1-beta, and leptin at elevated levels around the clock. It activates that NF-kappa-B in surrounding tissues. It drives the Th17 Treg imbalance. It suppresses the adiponectin. And because insulin resistance and visceral adiposity tends to increase over time without intervention, this inflammatory source tends to escalate rather than resolve. And these are all things that we've covered in the last two episodes. So if you want to know more about this, jump back and have a listen to those. The specific clinical marker, so waist circumference, is a predictor of visceral adipose tissue. And it's associated inflammatory output, and it's better than the BMI. You can be at a so-called healthy BMI with a metabolically active visceral fat burden that is generating a significant inflammatory load. The next source that I want to look at is gut-derived inflammation. And we looked at the gut-immune connection back in March, and it belongs here as a primary inflammatory source. When the gut lining is compromised, increased intestinal permeability, gut dysbiosis, loss of mucosal integrity, bacterial endotoxins, particularly lipopolysaccharide from gram-negative bacteria, enter the bloodstream. Lipopolysaccharide, so LPS, is one of the most potent activators of NF-kappa-B known. Even subclinical endotoxemia, LPS entering the circulation at levels that is too low to cause that acute illness, produces a sustained systemic pro-inflammatory state that has been measured in human studies and is associated with insulin resistance, obesity, and metabolic disease. And this is called metabolic endotoxemia. And it represents a direct link between the gut barrier function, the metabolic environment, and systemic inflammation. A high fat, high sugar, low fiber diet promotes both the gram-negative bacterial overgrowth that produces LPS and the gut barrier dysfunction that allows it through. And this is one of the mechanisms by which the Western dietary pattern generates metabolic and inflammatory disease, not solely through macronutrient composition, but through its effect on the gut barrier and the endotoxin exposure that follows. So the next source I want to look at is glycemic dysregulation and advanced glycation end products. When we see someone who has those glucose spikes following a meal, which that's that sharp blood sugar rises, usually following refined carbohydrate consumption, and that occur repeatedly in insulin-resistant individuals, they are independently pro-inflammatory over and above their contribution to insulin resistance. High glucose directly activates NF-kappa-B in endothelial cells, smooth muscle cells, and immune cells through at least four distinct molecular pathways, and increased production of advanced glycation end products. Now, advanced glycation end products are formed when glucose molecules non-enzymatically bind to proteins and lipids in a process called glycation. The resulting molecular modifications impair protein function and generate reactive oxygen species. These advanced glycation end products bind to specific receptors on immune and endothelial cells, and the activation of that is a potent NF-kappa-B activator in its own right. And this axis produces a feed-forward inflammatory loop that is independent of glucose level at the time of measurement. It reflects the cumulative glycemic history, which is why individuals with long-standing insulin resistance and repeated spikes in glucose following meals carry a substantial advanced glycation end product burden, even when their current glucose is within range. The fourth source that I want to look at is that chronic psychological and physiological stress. And we covered the stress-inflammation connection in the third week of March. So here I want to focus specifically on the mechanism by which chronic stress maintains inflammatory tone rather than resolving it, because you can jump back to that episode and have a listen to that one if you haven't already. The acute stress response, so cortisol and adrenaline, is, as we described in March, initially anti-inflammatory. The problem is glucocorticoid resistance. With sustained cortisol elevation, immune cells downregulate glucocorticoid receptor expression and sensitivity. The anti-inflammatory signal is effectively ignored. The cells become cortisol resistant in the same way that insulin-resistant cells become insulin-resistant. The receptor becomes desensitized to the signal by repeated overexposure. Once glucocorticoid resistance develops, the HPA axis loses its capacity to downregulate the immune response. Pro-inflammatory cytokines, TNF-alpha, IL-6, IL-1-beta, increase unchecked. And because the psychological stressor that drove the original cortisol elevation is often chronic and unresolvable, so things like relationship difficulty, financial pressures, occupational stress, the physiological stress of chronic illness itself maybe, that loop persists indefinitely. We can't just get rid of some of these stresses in life. The body is simultaneously producing the inflammatory signal and losing its capacity to dampen it. And then the fifth source that I want to look at for this chronic inflammation is environmental and dietary pro-inflammatory inputs. And this is the category that encompasses the specific dietary and environmental inputs that activate that NF-kappa-B directly, independent of the metabolic pathways we've already looked at. The most clinically significant in my practice are trans fatty acids. So those industrial produced, partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, which are a potent NF-kappa-B activator and whose consumption is directly associated with elevated CRP and IL-6 in multiple studies. Excess omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids relative to those omega-3s, so the anti-inflammatory ones. The modern dietary ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 is approximately 15 or 20 to 1 versus the estimated ancestral ratio of 4 to 1. And because omega-6 and omega-3 compete for the same enzymatic pathways, excess omega-6 effectively crowds out the anti-inflammatory prostaglandin and resolvin synthesis that omega-3 enables. And the advanced glycation end products that are formed during high temperature cooking of processed foods, so things like fried foods and ultra processed foods and even alcohol, create more of these advanced glycation end products. And this is directly cytotoxic to gut epithelial cells and stimulates that LPS translocation. And then there's environmental toxins, including persistent organic pollutants and heavy metals, which accumulate in adipose tissue and generate oxidative stress and NF-kappa-B activation. The clinical implication, dietary quality is not primarily a macronutrient question in the context of chronic inflammation. It is a question of inflammatory load. A diet high in refined carbohydrate, industrial seed oils, ultra-processed foods, alcohol, and low in omega-3 fatty acids, polyphenols, fiber, and antioxidants is not merely unhealthy in a vague sense. It is continuously activating that NF-kappa B through multiple simultaneous pathways, generating a sustained pro-inflammatory state that the resolution systems just cannot keep up with. So what does this chronic inflammation do to the body on a systemic level? The downstream consequences of chronic low-grade inflammation read like a functional medicine patient's presenting complaint list, and this is not a coincidence. So let's look through some of the major systemic effects. First, we've got mitochondrial dysfunction and energy production. Chronic inflammation impairs mitochondrial function through two primary mechanisms. First, the reactive oxygen species generated by immune activation cause oxidative damage to mitochondrial membranes, electron transport chain components, and mitochondrial DNA, which, unlike nuclear DNA, has limited repair capacity. Second, the pro-inflammatory cytokine environment, so particularly that TNF-alpha, directly suppresses something called PGC1-alpha, which is the master regulator of mitochondrial biogenesis, so the production and repair of more mitochondria. The cells produce fewer new mitochondria, and the existing mitochondria become less efficient. So your ATP output falls. That's your energy currency. The cellular energy deficit manifests as the profound fatigue that sleep cannot resolve, because the problem is not at the level of rest, it is at the level of cellular energy production. Then we have brain function and neuroinflammation. The brain was long considered immunologically privileged, protected from the peripheral immune system by the blood-brain barrier. We now understand that chronic peripheral inflammation breaches this protection through multiple routes. Pro-inflammatory cytokines, including those things like IL-6, TNF-alpha, cross the blood-brain barrier directly at areas of relative permeability. They activate brain-resident immune cells, the microglia, which then amplify the inflammatory signal within the central nervous system, and they impair the tight junctions of the blood-brain barrier itself, so increasing the permeability over time. The result is neuroinflammation. We get microglial activation, reduced neuroplasticity, impaired synaptic function, and reduced production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, which is essential for neuronal health and cognitive function. The clinical picture of neuroinflammation is the symptom cluster of almost every patient I see, and that what they describe as their most debilitating feature, and that is brain fog. The word-finding difficulty, the reduced processing speed, the concentration that was sharp at 30 but sluggish at 40. And beneath the immediate functional symptoms, neuroinflammation accelerates that neurodegenerative trajectory. The same microglial activation and reduced BDNF that produces cognitive symptoms in middle age is, at sustained levels, a risk factor for things like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease in the long term. And then we have hormonal disruption. Chronic inflammation disrupts hormonal function at multiple levels of the endocrine system. At the hypothalamic level, inflammatory cytokines suppress GnRH, gonadotropin-releasing hormone. Then we get reduced LH and FSH signaling to the ovaries and the testes, and then we get impaired sex hormone production. This is one mechanism through which chronic illness and sustained inflammatory load is associated with low testosterone in men and menstrual irregularities and reduced ovarian function in women. At the adrenal level, IL-1 beta and TNF-alpha directly stimulate cortisol production, contributing to that HPA dysregulation that we've covered extensively. At the thyroid level, as we discussed in last week's episode, inflammatory cytokines suppress that deiodinase activity and impair that T4 to T3 conversion. And at the level of the ovary specifically, chronic inflammation impairs the follicular environment required for ovulation and egg quality, contributing to the reduced fertility that accompanies chronic inflammatory conditions. Next, we have to consider the cardiovascular risk. The inflammatory pathogenesis of cardiovascular disease is now well established as the lipid hypothesis, and in many ways more clinically useful. Atherosclerosis is not fundamentally a disease of excess cholesterol. It's a disease of arterial wall inflammation in which cholesterol is involved. The initiating event is endothelial activation by inflammatory stimuli, which leads to the expression of adhesion molecules on the arterial endothelium, the recruitment of monocytes into the intima, their differentiation into macrophages, and the formation of the inflammatory plaque that is the substrate of coronary artery disease and stroke. Elevated hsCRP is one of the strongest predictors of future cardiovascular events. in some analyses outperforming LDL cholesterol as a risk marker. So we have to look at the inflammatory signal as a clinical priority, not just cholesterol level. And then we have accelerated aging and cellular senescence. Chronic inflammation accelerates the biological aging process through two mechanisms that are now well characterized. The first is telomere attrition. So inflammatory oxidative stress accelerates the shortening of our telomeres, which are the protective caps on chromosomes that shorten with each cell division and whose length correlates with biological age. Chronically inflamed individuals have measurably shorter telomeres than their age-matched non-inflamed counterparts. And the older we get, the shorter our telomeres. So we are aging faster. The second is the senescence-associated secretory phenotype, the SASP. Senescent cells that have stopped dividing but have not been cleared, produce large quantities of pro-inflammatory cytokines, chemokines, and proteases. This SASP creates a local inflammatory environment that accelerates senescence in neighboring cells. So a self-propagating inflammatory cascade at a tissue level. The accumulation of senescent cells with age is now one of the primary targets of the longevity medicine field, and chronic inflammation is one of its primary drivers. So given everything that we've just covered, the sources, the mechanisms, the downstream consequences, the next question is, how do we actually see this in clinical assessment? How do we measure inflammatory load in a way that captures the chronic subclinical picture that standard testing misses? So we can look at high sensitivity CRP, and we covered HSCRP in the final episode of March. Standard CRP is calibrated for acute inflammation and is clinically silent below 5 mg/L. High sensitivity CRP detects the range associated with chronic low-grade inflammation, so typically between 0.1 and 5. That is the clinical territory of cardiovascular risk, metabolic inflammation, and immune dysregulation. In functional medicine, we look at a target of below 1. Values between 1 and 3 indicate maybe potentially moderate chronic inflammatory load, and values above 3 potentially indicate significant inflammatory burden. It's a simple, inexpensive test that should be in any standard chronic disease or preventative health assessment. Then we have things like ESR and plasma viscosity. And these are older inflammatory markers that remain clinically useful alongside the HSCRP. They reflect the acute phase response and can be elevated in the context of significant chronic inflammatory load. They're less specific than the HSCRP, but they are widely available on NHS panels, and they can flag that chronic inflammatory picture that merits further investigation. Then we have homocysteine. So homocysteine is an amino acid produced during methionine metabolism, whose elevation is associated with both cardiovascular risk and systemic inflammation. Elevated homocysteine directly damages endothelial cells and activates that NF-kappa-B. So it's both a consequence and a driver of inflammatory vascular disease. It's also a sensitive marker of B vitamin status, specifically things like folate, B6, and B12, whose insufficiency impairs the methylation cycle that converts homocysteine to the harmless products of cysteine and methionine. In inflammatory patients, elevated homocysteine frequently indicates methylation dysfunction alongside active inflammatory load. Then we can look at fasting glucose and insulin together as an inflammatory index. As we looked at a couple of weeks ago, we can look at things like your HOMA-IR, and that is clinically significant when we're looking at insulin resistance. And we do that by looking at your fasting glucose and your insulin levels together. We can also look then at your stool microbiome and inflammatory markers. Fecal calprotectin and lactoferrin are markers of intestinal immune activation. White blood cell proteins released into the gut lumen when immune cells are recruited to the intestinal mucosa in response to inflammation. They provide a direct window into the gut inflammatory picture. Elevated calprotectin indicates active intestinal inflammation. And in the context of a gut inflammatory metabolic assessment, it helps to quantify the contribution of gut-derived inflammation to the systemic picture. We can also look at zonulin, a protein that regulates the tight junction permeability. It's used in some functional medicine practices as a marker of intestinal permeability. However, it does have some technical limitations. We need to look at zonulin in conjunction with clinical history and with other markers. Together, this full picture of all of these markers give a genuinely complete picture of inflammatory load and its metabolic, vascular, and gut-derived drivers. And this is not an exotic panel, with the exception of the stool markers, which are not generally accessible. A comprehensive stool test is not generally accessible on the NHS. Most of these are available on the NHS or privately at a relatively modest cost. The gap here is quite often not on whether the tests are available, but on whether anyone has actually thought to run them together and interpret them as a joined up picture. So now let's turn to what actually reduces chronic inflammation. And let's have a look at the evidence base that we have out there. I want to give you the interventions that have the strongest and most consistent evidence for reducing chronic inflammatory load and things that I use in clinical practice. And this is not a complete list of everything that might help, but it is a framework that you can return to. And these are the things that I see in almost every patient who has that chronic inflammatory picture. So first, omega-3 fatty acids, the EPA and DHA. EPA and DHA are the most potent dietary anti-inflammatory compounds available. They are the precursors to the resolution mediators, the resolvins, the protectins, the myrosins that are required for the active resolution phase in inflammation. Without adequate EPA and DHA, the resolution program cannot complete. In the context of chronic inflammation, where the resolution phase is perpetually failing to engage, omega-3 supplementation is not a general wellness intervention. It is a direct anti-inflammatory mechanism. And the evidence here is substantial. There's meta-analysis that consistently show that high-dose fish oil supplementation reduces that circulating TNF-alpha, IL-6, and hsCRP. The anti-inflammatory effect is dose-dependent and can take around 8 to 12 weeks to reach full effect. So it's not something, much like most things in functional medicine, it's not something that happens overnight. This reflects the time that is required to meaningfully alter the fatty acid composition of cell membranes. The omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in cell membranes is the determinant, and shifting it requires sustained therapeutic dose supplementation, not often the amounts that are found in your standard multivitamins. Then we have polyphenol-rich nutrition, so dietary polyphenols, the compounds responsible for the color and bitterness of plant foods. And these are direct NF-kappa-B inhibitors. So things like resveratrol, quercetin, curcumin, EGCG, which we get from green tea, and the anthocyanins, which come from berries and dark vegetables. These all inhibit NF-kappa-B activation through multiple molecular mechanisms. They reduce NLRP3 inflammasome in activation and support the antioxidant response element that coordinates the body's endogenous antioxidant defenses. The practical dietary translation, diversity and abundance of deeply colored plant foods, not supplementation as a replacement for dietary quality, is what is really going to work here is anti-inflammatory. We need a polyphenol-rich dietary foundation. And I talk to my patients about a target of 50 different plant foods per week, 30 being the minimum. And we've discussed this before in the context of microbiome diversity, but it is also the most practical single dietary goal for maximizing polyphenol diversity and anti-inflammatory dietary breadth simultaneously. So getting as many different plant foods per week as you can. And this means not repeating. So when we say 50 different plant foods per week, you can eat broccoli as many times as you like. But if you eat broccoli on a Monday, you can't add it to your list on a Tuesday. You can only add each food once a week. And this is any plant food. So herbs and spices are great here because you can really boost your numbers by throwing loads of herbs into things, throwing spices into cooking. Things like turmeric, ginger, rosemary, thyme. And these are also among some of the most polyphenol-dense foods that are available and contribute meaningfully to the dietary anti-inflammatory picture when used regularly. Next, we want to look at that blood sugar and insulin stability. So we want to stabilize those glucose spikes through the dietary carbohydrate quality interventions. And we touched on some of this two episodes ago. But what we want to see is combining protein at every meal, post-meal movement, and sleep optimization. These are some of the most consistently anti-inflammatory interventions available. The anti-inflammatory effect of blood sugar stabilization in these ways is measurable within weeks. hsCRP typically falls, endothelial inflammatory markers improve, and the AGE burden begins to reduce as glycation is slowed. You cannot out-supplement a diet that is continuously generating glycemic-driven inflammation. Next, we need to look at gut repair and microbiome support, so reducing that metabolic endotoxemia. The gut-derived LPS translocation that affects that activates the NF-kappa-B systemically requires repairing the gut barrier and reducing gram-negative bacterial overgrowth. So the 4R framework for that gut repair that we looked at back at the beginning of March, and we'll link that episode in the show notes below this one, looks at removing inflammatory triggers, replacing digestive support, re-inoculating the microbiome, and repairing the gut lining. The specific anti-inflammatory relevance here, things like L-glutamine and zinc carnosine repair the gut-tight junctions, directly reduce LPS translocation. Prebiotic fibers feed the butyrate-producing bacteria whose metabolite, butyrate, is a direct NF-kappa-B inhibitor and a primary signal for regulatory T-cell differentiation. A diet high in diverse fermentable fiber is one of the most powerful anti-inflammatory dietary strategies available because it works through the microbiome to produce endogenous anti-inflammatory compounds. Then we have to look at lifestyle, so sleep. This is the anti-inflammatory reset. During slow wave sleep, which is the deep sleep stage that requires consistent sleep duration and timing in order to access it, the brain's lymphatic system clears inflammatory debris, including amyloid beta and tau proteins, from the interstitial fluid. Growth hormone released during deep sleep has direct anti-inflammatory effects on peripheral tissues, and cortisol reduces overnight, allowing the inflammatory suppression that the HPA axis provides in acute bursts to be partially restored. Even one night of sleep deprivation measurably increases circulating IL-6 and TNF-alpha and reduces NK cell cytotoxicity. Chronic sleep restriction is a state of chronic immune activation. Restoring sleep architecture is not just supportive to the anti-inflammatory program, it is a primary component of it. And then we have to look at movement as an anti-inflammatory intervention. Exercise has direct reproducible anti-inflammatory effects. Skeletal muscle contraction releases myokines, particularly IL-6, paradoxically in this context, but in its muscle-derived rather than adipose-driven form, which has an anti-inflammatory rather than pro-inflammatory effect when produced acutely by contracting muscle. We also see fat oxidation, mitochondrial biogenesis, and anti-inflammatory macrophage polarization. Meta-analysis of exercise intervention trials consistently shows reductions in things like your hsCRP, TNF-alpha, and IL-6 with regular moderate intensity exercise. So it doesn't need to be really intense. And these effects are independent of weight change. And they appear within 8 to 12 weeks of consistent training. Resistance training specifically reduces that visceral adipose tissue and the inflammatory cytokine output that is associated with it. And the caveat worth making here is very high intensity exercise in individuals who have inflammatory load and poor recovery capacity, particularly those with adrenal dysregulation, can initially worsen inflammatory markers through oxidative stress and cortisol elevation. So that dose response relationship matters. For most of my patients, the entry point is moderate movement, walking, swimming, resistance training at manageable loads, rather than high intensity training, which can actually add progressively to the inflammatory and adrenal picture. So I want to come back to the questions that I asked at the start. The morning stiffness, the fatigue that rest doesn't fix, the brain fog, the weight that resists your efforts, the immunity that keeps letting you down, the skin that flares, the mood that sits lower than it should. These are not random. They are not a collection of bad luck. They are clinical signature of chronic low-grade inflammation, an immune system in a state of sustained activation signaling that something in the internal environment is generating a threat it cannot resolve. It's not a malfunction. It is, in its own terms, working correctly. The signal is appropriate. It is the source of the signal that needs to change. And that is the reframe that I want you to take from this episode. Chronic inflammation is not a disease to be suppressed. It is a warning system that needs to be listened to. The question is not, how do I turn this off? The question is, what is generating this signal and how do I address it at the source? And for most of my patients, the sources are identifiable. The metabolic driver, the gut driver, the dietary driver, the stress driver, the sleep driver. These are not mysteries. They are addressable and they are all things that we've been looking at in these recent episodes. Of the five sources of chronic inflammation that we've covered today, the metabolic adipose driver, the gut-derived inflammation, the glycemic dysregulation, the chronic stress, the dietary pro-inflammatory load, which one do you think is the most significant contributor to your own picture right now? And they might all be present, but not all of them equally, or some might be present, some might not. But there is usually a primary driver. And identifying it is where the clinical work becomes genuinely targeted rather than general wellness orientated. And in my book, Optimal You, we cover inflammation. We look at the immune system and you can get the full framework looking at all of these pillars. We cover the hormones, the gut, the immune system, the brain, the cardiometabolic picture, the sources, the markers, the interventions. And it's part of a complete 12-pillar picture. If you want to understand your own inflammatory load and work with it systematically, then this is a really great starting point. And we'll put a link in the show notes so that you can grab a copy of my book now. It's also available in all good bookstores and, of course, on Amazon. The 7-day reset is also specifically designed as an anti-inflammatory week, removing those primary dietary drivers of inflammation, adding in the foods that you need. 7 days, £7.99. The inflammatory response to a consistent week of this is measurable. And again, we'll link this in the show notes below. Next week, we'll look at what a functional medicine approach to metabolic health actually looks like in practice, what changes in those first 8 weeks, and what I look at when a patient comes to me with the full metabolic inflammatory picture. It's going to be a really clinically concrete episode next week. You've been listening to the Good Health Podcast. I'm Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner, autoimmune and thyroid specialist, and author of Optimal You. You can find me at goodhealth.uk, that's G-O-O-D-E health.uk, on Instagram at Good Health Clinic, that's G-O-O-D-E Health Clinic, and wherever you get your podcasts. Show notes and all resources are linked below, and I'll see you next week.